last case, 2023-0169. Disciplinary Council versus Carter. On behalf of the respondent, Mr. McNamara.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning.
And good morning to all. Haven't been here in maybe 2 years, but consider it an honor when I do. It's going to change my presentation a little bit in view of what I've sat through for 40 minutes and tell you there are no race judicata or collateral estoppel or issues of any sort like that in Disciplinary Council versus Kelly in 2009, this court held that you are not bound by any factual or legal conclusions of the Board of Professional Conduct. It had a different name then, but do you know what I mean? And you remain free to exercise your independent judgment as to evidentiary weight and applicable law. So, fresh sheet, one issue at least we don't have to address. The brief filed by disciplinary counsel uses, maybe, I don't know if inflammatory is the right word, but some language, for example, calling Greg Carter a predator. And he's not. He's 62, practiced 35 or so years without any disciplinary history. And the facts of this case are that from March 2nd of 2020 through July 27th, about 5 months, there was mutual flirtation between he and JG, and that she came to his office voluntarily. He asked her to, but she had no obligation, didn't have to come, could have walked out at any time she wanted. And for some reason that I'm not sure I'll ever understand, she recorded that meeting until either battery died, whatever happened, like 21 minutes into it, but almost all of it. And Mr. Carter didn't know it was being recorded, but still, right as the sexual conduct was about to begin, said, and it's on the tape, "Are you sure? You know how shy you are." That's not a predator's comment to a victim. That's one man's comment to a woman. She also claimed in her testimony at the hearing before the board that she screamed no and stop, but none of it's on the recording. It's just not there. Disciplinary counsel also describes JG as a vulnerable victim. And I'd submit she was neither. I think it's important that you look at the pictures that are...
Why is she not a vulnerable victim?
On the way there right now. If you look at the pictures that are identified as stipulated Exhibit 25, she was self-confident. She appeared in no distress, actually smiling. She did nothing that she didn't want to do. As I said, she could have left at any time. She didn't say no. She didn't say stop. And he did say, "Are you sure?"
So she says that she's there to talk about a gentleman's release on post-release control. She needs him to get out in order to support her children. She says on the tape that she is shy. He even admits that he texted her sometime beforehand, but she never returned that text and why. And she goes on to talk about how he has all the power. How is that not vulnerable?
How is that not what?
Vulnerable.
She didn't have to be there at all.
She's coming because he called her up and said, "I want to talk to you about the motion to release this gentleman on post-release control."
I don't think that's...
That's not on the tape? I listened to the tape twice.
They did discuss it, certainly. He read the whole thing.
He read the whole thing, and he says, this is why I called you. This is where I need your help. What is an LPN? And she talks about what he did. How is she not a vulnerable individual when she's there talking to a lawyer about filing a motion for post-release control to get someone out of prison to support her children?
She wasn't hiring him to file the motion.
Well, that would be another issue of why would he call her then? Why not call the mother? Why not call someone else in the family who was paying the bill?
He had no, because this wasn't really about McLean or the bill. This was social. This was a man and a woman. There had been this flirting for 5 months.
Counsel, that's why I really want to ask. Did I not read that there was a stipulation to an 8.4 violation?
Which is the 8.4? The dishonesty, you mean?
Conduct.
Conduct that reflects adversely on lawyers' fitness to practice law, which demands a clear and convincing standard.
No, there was a stipulation that he lied to the detective.
So the report, which says on paragraph 35, since the respondent stipulated to violating professional code rule 8.4C, and panel finds the violation occurred, that's incorrect.
We stipulated, and this is in our objection to findings of fact, he acknowledged that his initial dishonesty with the detective constituted a violation of rule 8.4C.
Okay, so that's limited to that issue?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
And it reflected badly. He corrected it on the same call, but it was there, and he owned up to it.
Counselor, assuming that for the sake of argument that we believe or think that disciplinary counsel's characterization of Mr. Carter is unwarranted, the characterization as a predator, assuming that, is what happened in his office still violation of 8.4?
I think not, and I'll get to that in a bit, or I'll do it right now if you want.
Whichever you prefer.
All right. Let me get back just for a moment to JG and her reaction and whether she's traumatized or harmed. I would say it was so bad that she never complained to anyone ever. 8 months, I mean, didn't call the police, didn't complain to family, didn't write to the bars, never did a thing, and in fact, hung up on the detective and didn't cooperate much with their investigation. She told McLean 8 months later, all the motions have come and gone, every legal work's done, everything's done. And she told McLean about it, and he wrote a letter complaining to the Licking County Bar Association that got forwarded to the police department, then to the prosecutor, then to disciplinary counsel. She never complained and was generally not very cooperative with the investigation when it started, and they didn't find, based on anything she had to say, that there were charges to be filed.
So if this is like disciplinary counsel versus Owen, where there's a conflict because even though she's not his wife, she's the mother of his child.
Well, Owen
I'm looking at the conflict of interest.
Owen was night and day different. There is no conflict of interest here, in my opinion. Owen was shacked up in a motel with the wife during the capital trial of the defendant. It's a blatant conflict of interest. If his client's found not guilty, his relationship with the wife ends.
That might be more blatant, but why isn't this similar?
J.G. was not even girlfriend to McLean at the time the mother came and hired Carter.
But she's the mother of his children.
She had four children. He's the father of one of them.
Okay.
At the time she met Greg Carter, she was living with the father of two other of the children and in a relationship with that man.
But did she meet, was her encounter with Mr. Carter, did she meet Mr. Carter based on representation of Mr. McLean, is it?
McLean. She came to the meeting with Ms. Fabian, the mother of the prisoner, because they're friends.
And because she was paying for it.
Well, the mother was paying for it.
Wasn't there evidence?
Later, she said she'd loaned mom some money, but that was never told to Carter, and there was, it was mom who called, mom who made the appointment, mom who gave him the money.
So how did she get to be brought into discussions of McLean's motions?
She came in March to the first, the mother of McLean called first, they talked, they scheduled an appointment, I think it was March 2nd, 2020. That was Ms. Fabian. JG is a friend of Ms. Fabian, went with her to that meeting at Mr. Carter's office. And obviously she had some interest in McLean because he's the father of one of her children, and the child should have a dad, she should have her support, whatever interest in that regard there might be, legitimately. So that's why she went. She continued to have contact, phone, text, whatever, with Greg Carter between then and July, when he sent the message asking her to come to his office. And subterfuge, if you want to call it that, it was personal to him. It wasn't business.
Well, you're saying they never discussed anything about the motions filed for McLean?
No, I'm not saying he never discussed it. I'm saying his underlying purpose was personal and not to do with
McLean. Why was the sexual act referred to as a reward for his services?
After they read the motion and talked, he said, well, and she said, you did a really nice job, or some compliment. He said, well, do I get my reward? And they said he touched his fingers either to his cheek, lips, somewhere like that.
But I still want to go back to, you know, we can all, in our suits and our robes, look at, you know, a monogamous situation and say, oh, and where someone's married and say, oh, that's different from a situation where someone probably has lived a more chaotic life than you or I have and may have multiple fathers of different children, may not have even one marriage, and but still has a relationship with that individual, and she cared enough to be involved in the case because he's the father, apparently, because he's the father of her child or whatever reason she has. Why would we differentiate from at least starting with Owen as a basis of looking at that conflict of interest?
I think there is a difference when there is a romantic relationship, personal relationship, as opposed to your baby daddy to pay child support and to assist with upbringing or whatever parental help you can give. I think that's different than husband and wife.
Why aren't we respecting someone who didn't have the advantages that others have had to be able to go through that middle class or upper middle class life?
I don't think it's advantages. I don't think this is an economic issue. I think it is personal relationship versus father of my child. Personal, romantic type relationship. And I think the wife of a client is different than the former girlfriend of a client. So I see Owen as quite different. Owen went on for a longer period of time. Owen had a trial in progress when he was seeing the wife. The guy ended up getting his conviction set aside because of the conflict of interest, and was granted a new trial. It was significantly different, I think, than Greg Carter with the ex-girlfriend now involved in a personal relationship with the father of two other kids, and not involved with his client in any romantic or family or living together sense, other than he's the dad of one of her children. If you look at all of the cases cited by disciplinary counsel, I also read all of the cases that were recited in an opinion just last Thursday in Mr. Russ's case. There's a little overlap, but the opinion from this court last week. There are out of 14, whatever, There are two cases where the victim at issue was an employee. One was a regular employee that was often solicited for sex and maybe even told that her job would be dependent upon it. There was another one, Miss, I think, was a law school student, legal intern in the office, who was pursued sexually by a lawyer. So there were two of those cases that were employees. Other than those two, every single one was either a client or, in one case, a wife of a client, and in one case, a wife of a client and a client. He filed a bankruptcy for both. But in every single one, D.C. Disciplinary Council versus Booher was 1996, and the quote said, a sexual relationship between a lawyer and a client during the course of the professional relationship is inherently insidious and insidiously harmful. A client. Disciplinary Council versus Sarver, 2018, it says it impugns the legal system as a whole when the client turns to an attorney for help only to be exploited for the lawyer's sexual gratification. One of them, of course, was Owen. One of them was Disciplinary Council versus Benbow, that you may recall is a lawyer who was having a sexual relationship with a client and was actually some fondling going on in a conference room at the courthouse while they were waiting for a hearing that was shown on video and they found out about it. He was uncooperative during the disciplinary process, but more important, it's a client. All of those led to 6-month suspensions, 1 year, 2 year for Owen, I think, but 1 year for some, but actual suspensions from the practice of law, and they should. Leon was the respondent's name, 2018, where it was a bankruptcy case, and he represented husband and wife both, and had intercourse at his office with the wife. Obviously, that's conflict. Obviously, that's taking advantage of a client. I mean, that's bad in every way it's possible. When he got caught, and it was obvious it had happened, he wouldn't even give him the fee back for the bankruptcy until there was a court order to make him. In the one that was an employee, Skolnick, not the law student, but the other one, that person is described as a very vulnerable employee with a pattern of harassment, long time, went on over a period of time. All of those cases led to actual suspensions. 1 year with half stayed, 2 years with 1 year stayed, 2 years I think it was for Jim Owen. They all were suspended, and I agree they all should have been.
Thank you.
Pardon?
You're over time.
I will sit down. Thank you very much.
On behalf of Disciplinary Council, Ms. Asif.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chief Justice Kennedy, may it please the court. Martha Asif on behalf of the Office of Disciplinary Counsel. Respondent Gregory Carter exploited his client relationship by luring the mother of his client's young child to his office under false pretenses, as the Board of Professional Conduct found, and then sought sex as a reward for his legal work. He admits freely that his intentions in having her arrive at his office that day were for his own personal interests. He later lied to a police detective when confronted about his sexual conduct. The Board of Professional Conduct correctly found 3 rule violations in this case. Given the seriousness of respondents' misconduct and the overarching need to protect the public, a serious sanction is warranted in this case in the form of an actual suspension as recommended by the board. I'd like to briefly, before getting into the rest of our argument, respond to a couple of issues that were raised by respondent's counsel. First of all, JG met respondent for the first time in his office on March 2nd of 2020. She was not contacted him, or did not have further contact with him in person until July 27th of 2020, which was the date of the meeting in their office. Respondent seemed to imply that there was a pattern of flirting between these two dates, as if there were additional text messages or phone calls between the two, when in fact there is no such evidence of anything like that. And I would direct the court to page 70 of the hearing transcript when JG was asked during her testimony whether there had been any contact. Certainly the first text message that respondent ever sent to JG was on the date of the interaction in his office, which was on July 27th of 2020.
Did Mr. Carter concede that there had been no contact between those two dates?
Yes, Your Honor. We conducted discovery in this case. He was asked whether there were further phone calls or text messages. Nothing like that was ever provided. And certainly we did our own discovery as well and did not locate any such
And remind me again, please, who initiated the contact for the second meeting?
It was Mr. Carter. He sent a text message to JG. This is stipulated Exhibit 23 in the record. And he identified himself not as Greg or Mr. Carter. He identified himself as Eric's lawyer and said, can you come to my office today? And today was underlined in the interaction.
I had a question. I forgot that pass. Go on. I'll remember it before it's.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel,
yes.
The 8.4. There were two 8.4 violations, right?
Yes, sir.
Dishonesty and fitness, whatever
yes.
the one is. If I'm remembering correctly, that case law generally then leads to timeout.
We agree. Yes.
Am I wrong about that?
No, Your Honor. There is a certain
sexual stuff.
Right.
I'm talking about honesty.
Yes. There is a stipulated violation of Rule 8.4C in this case. The basis of that violation is respondent's admitted lie to law enforcement. And this court has, starting with the case law in Disciplinary Counsel versus Fauerbaugh, has repeatedly held that the presumptive sanction for an attorney's dishonest conduct is an actual suspension. And certainly in this case, we would argue that an actual suspension is also warranted by the sexual conduct.
Is that to punish him? Or
I'm sorry, is there any exception that would apply to the timeout under 8.4?
Under 8.4C?
Yeah.
No, not in our view, Your Honor. And the two cases that were cited by respondent are two older cases, and it's Kenny and Carroll that were decided under the previous disciplinary rule, so they're not 8.4C cases. But the exception is found in situations where there are significant mitigating circumstances, mitigating evidence. And certainly we would contend that this is not one of those cases.
And didn't he come clean that he did lie?
Right. What happened, Your Honor, was this was still in the context of the interview with the police detective. And so when the police detective asked him, did anything sexual happen in your office between you and JG? His initial reaction was not just to lie and deny the contact, but to turn it around on JG and said, she attempted some advances, but I rebuffed that. I didn't reciprocate that. And then, fortunately for him, the police detective decided to come clean with him and let him know that he had an audio recording of the interaction that the detective had already listened to. So at that point, not because he knew it was the right thing to do, but because he was caught in a lie, he then admitted, okay, well, we did have a sexual contact in my office, but it was still really all her.
Okay, so assuming there's a good basis for the violations, to protect the public, which we always say is not designed to punish, but to protect the public, why is a 6-month actual suspension warranted? How does that correlate to protecting the public?
That's really the crux of the request for the sanction in this case, Your Honor. Absolutely. We're not interested in punishing Mr. Carter or any other attorney, but there is the need to protect the public. In this case, Mr. Carter has never acknowledged the wrongfulness of his conduct. Even to this day, in his objections filed with this court, he's continuing to minimize his conduct, to blame JG, as if her conduct, rather than his own, is the subject of this court's inquiry, when that is not the case. He manipulated a vulnerable person for his own benefit. And notably, the board found not only that she was vulnerable and he caused her harm, but that he used her vulnerability to cause her harm. So given those set of facts, that warrants the need for an actual suspension in this case. And I would also point out, Mr. Carter's client base consists almost entirely of indigent criminal defendants. He has ready access to a group of people who are vulnerable just because of their financial status in life and their need for his services, as well as given that individuals are often incarcerated, as Mr. McLean was here, he's interacting with their vulnerable family members as well. And given the fact that he doesn't see anything wrong with his propositioning and sexual contact with JG in this case, the court can have no assurance that he's learned anything from this experience and will not engage in conduct similar in the future.
So wouldn't a longer stayed suspension act as a deterrent to any future behavior, to rather than if you take him out of his employment, all those vulnerable people that he represents right now are going to be affected by that?
Certainly, the court's case law, both on the 8.4H charge and the 8.4C charge, as well as the need to protect the public, warrant an actual suspension. In this case, given that Mr. Carter still cannot bring himself to acknowledge the wrongfulness of his conduct or the fact that he hurt somebody as a result of his interactions in this case, he needs the actual time off to continue to cope with the harm that he has brought in this case and how he has misused and exploited his client relationship.
Ms. Asif, do you think there's a difference in our case law between the scenario here where JG was not the client, was not the wife or partner or paramour necessarily of the client, was not paying the bill, or at least to Mr. Carter's knowledge, was not paying the bill in any way. Does that differentiate this case from those where it is the client's spouse or paramour, or it is the client herself in the scenario, and that specific services of being the lawyer are tied to sexual favors? Do you see this case as different from those?
There, we argued below two separate bases for the 8.4H violation, and we also argued a conflict of interest below, which the board did not find. So the line of cases, starting with Leon and Owen, where the court is looking at the relationship between the client and the person that the attorney had sex with, certainly in this case, she was not the client. She was not the spouse of a client. But the court's consideration in those cases really relates to the attorney's position of dominance in the relationship and the vulnerability and dependence of the client. And we would argue that was present here. Mr. Carter treated JG effectively as a de facto member of Mr. McLean's family, as a client proxy. So just as if an attorney should not have sex with their client because of the power imbalance and should not have sex with a client's spouse, that could also be extended in this case to JG as a proxy for the actual client, Mr. McLean. But the court doesn't even need to reach that issue because of the findings of the Board of Professional Conduct. And that is that by itself, regardless of their relationship, but the relationship between JG and Mr. McLean, Mr. Carter lured JG to his office under false pretenses. She thought that she was going there for a client meeting. Mr. Carter admitted that was never the case. She was there for his personal interests.
But it is clear that she did not have to engage in the sexual conduct, that she could have left his office. He did not hold her against her will. Is that clear?
No.
No, it's not in your opinion?
What about when she said, I can't do this anymore, and then walked out? He didn't stop her, did he?
She was able to extricate herself at that point in the relationship, or in the interaction, Your Honor. But I would direct the court to the board's findings in paragraph 16 of the board report, where in addition to all the other circumstances that we've discussed here today, the board listened to JG's testimony and found that Mr. Carter grabbed her head and shoved her head into his genitals and tried to pull her up onto the desk in this case. Those are findings of the Board of Professional Conduct in this case.
Why did she feel she had to record this meeting?
Her testimony is that she thought it was unusual that she was being asked down to his office, given that Mr. McLean's mother, Debbie Fabian, was actually the primary client contact. She was nervous about it, and she didn't want Ms. Fabian to miss out on anything. So she wanted to make sure that whatever information was conveyed to her by Mr. Carter was recorded so that Ms. Fabian would
have. So she wasn't suspecting something was going to happen of this nature?
Not at all. Yeah. And we know that because she put all four of her children into a car, drove down to respondent's office, and left them in the car under the supervision of her eldest child while she ran up to Mr. Carter's office for what she thought would be a quick errand. Just to conclude briefly.
That last issue
yes.
goes to protection of the public, doesn't it?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Relator would ask the court to affirm the findings and the findings of misconduct and the factual findings of the board in this case, overrule the objections, and impose a sanction that would include an actual suspension from the practice of law. Thank you.
Mr. McNamara, good morning.
I'm not sure somebody asked if an actual suspension was presumptive or required for a violation of the dishonesty provisions. And we're told, yes, it is, that Feuerbaugh said that there should be an actual suspension. That was in 1995. All of the cases since have said that may be presumptive, but there are exceptions to it. And it depends on the circumstances, and there have been lots of exceptions to it. It's page 8 in objection number 3 of our brief talks about those other cases and would just say, whether from embarrassment, surprise, whatever, when the officer said that you had sexual relations with this lady, he said no, but he corrected it on the same phone call and thereafter made his phone available for the text, gave the pictures, cooperated with everything with the police, the prosecutor, and throughout the disciplinary process.
But only after he was, right over here, only after he was told there was a recording.
I don't know if it was after he was told that, but he was told that there was evidence of it, and he talked it. He'd known this detective before. They talked at some length, and he was informed that, oh, yes, you did, and we know it. And then he was truthful and opened up. I don't remember if it was the recording or otherwise, but it's the same. He said, yeah, you did, and we know it, and here's why. Okay. Same call, but you're right about that. Thank you.
Thank you. We will take the matter under advisement, and you will receive a decision from the court. Marshall, would you
all rise?
Close the court.
Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable.